Trust for Sustainable Living presents Speaking of Sustainability, a podcast about the environment and the issues our planet faces. Today, we'll be talking to Vasilis Gormas as part of our mini-series on climate action in response to the UN Climate Change Conference. Today's episode is hosted by Sunny Tierney. So, welcome, Vasilis, to the podcast. It's great to have you. Would you mind telling us a bit about yourself?
Yeah. Hello, Sunny. Thank you for inviting me. So I'm a third-year PhD student at the University of Cambridge in the Department of Land Economy, where I'm researching the impacts of protected areas such as national parks have on local communities. I'm lucky to be part of a very interesting community here at Cambridge. I work in the David Attenborough Building, where the Conservation Research Institute is hosted. And so I'm surrounded by different ecologists and plant scientists who are researching ways in which we can conserve nature better. And I'm one of the few natural scientists, few social scientists in the building. And I'm very excited to be there because very often I'm describing ways in which I'm collecting data from people and my colleagues are telling me about how they climb trees or go into rivers trying to collect data from different species. So it gives you a perspective on why you're doing what you're doing, having people like this around you.
Definitely. So as an environmental economist, could you tell us about some of the social impacts that are coming from the conservation of biodiversity?
Yeah, of course. That's a very good question. So the most popular and common way in which we've been conserving nature is by designing protected areas, which this many of us are familiar with these. We call them national parks in some countries. In other countries, we can call them reserves. And they vary on how strict they are. So what happens is very often you design these protected areas and people live in them. So if anyone's been here in the UK, in the Peak District or in Snowdonia, there's many people who live within the boundaries of the park. And these parks introduce certain restrictions which could be, which affect people who live in there and affect the local economy. These restrictions could apply to the way in which people are allowed to grow their food or fish and what kind of industries are permitted to develop. It could be restrictions on how many people can visit certain locations. And if these restrictions aren't designed properly, it could be quite disruptive for the local livelihoods of people and the way in which the local economy functions. And this is quite a Western model of conserving nature that we have adopted and we try to translate to international policy, because the way things work in Europe and very often in the United States as well, nature is quite separate from our urban societies. So we see nature as an area we go and visit to escape from our urban environments very often. So our relationship within is mostly touristic, but not exclusively, but mostly that. Whereas in many areas of the world, this distinction isn't as transparent and people rely on nature much more and they interact with it to a much greater level. So this is what I'm trying to study. In my research, I'm trying to determine how do protected areas in Europe specifically affect people's lives and the economy. And I'm trying to see to what extent protected areas are positive or not for a local being. And this is a very important question to ask because we've noticed that, and this is not just us, there's many researchers before us, that it's impossible to manage a protected area effectively unless you have the support of local people. Therefore, you need to ensure that the protected area has positive outcomes and that people are happy with it and they accept the protected area.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's really important to get the opinion of the people who are part of that community that you're, you know, like contributing towards, because they're the ones that are going to be living there.
Exactly.
So you've worked in quite a few areas in the last few years, such as corporate social responsibility projects in America, which included funding startups based in disadvantaged communities, converting abandoned houses into shelters for unaccompanied minors in Greece, as well as working in the shipping industry. So you've seen a pretty broad spectrum of environmental issues across the world. Can you tell us a bit about those projects and what did you learn coming away from them?
Yes, of course. When I graduated from my undergrad, I went and worked in development projects. The first one I worked in as an intern was a program where we funded startups by young people of color in areas that are disadvantaged in the United States. I focused in the Bronx in New York and in Miami-Dade County in Miami. Whereas the second project I worked on was quite, it was different, was closer to my heart because it was also geographically closer to my home, Greece. As many of you may remember, there was a big refugee crisis after the Syrian war, where many people were trying to make their way towards Europe in search of a better life. And in this transfer of people, there were many unaccompanied minor children. So these are people, children under the age of 18 that were looking for a shelter. And I was lucky to work with a really interesting group then, which collectively we converted housing, abandoned housing, into houses for refugees. So if I was trying to link these experiences to my current career, when I'm focusing more on environmental issues, I think there are two arguments to be made. The first one is that many of the problems that people are currently facing, which are labeled as social problems, are being created by different environmental degradation, for instance. So there are strong links to air pollution in cities affecting people's mood and obviously their health. There are also many cases of people in rural areas who don't have access to good quality land to grow food or productive land because of environmental reasons. And specifically in the refugee crisis, there are cases where people had to move away from the region because the region they're in has no longer access to water or because they don't have access to land. So I think that there are many links between social and environmental. Many of the environmental problems you currently are facing are created by poverty or other environmental issues, but the same is true for the reverse. And this is a relation that's very interesting to study. Climate refugees, it's a very interesting book as well by Mark Dawid, conservation refugees, if anyone is interested in reading this. I'm looking at this relationship between people and the environment because I think the best way in which we can design more effective conservation areas is by making them more inclusive. And the only way we can do that is by trying to learn more about how people rely on the environment and trying to protect this relationship that people have with the environment or to empower it even further so that people can get the livelihoods they deserve out of the environment while also protecting it and conserving it for future generations.
Yeah, definitely. So it really is like a cycle, really, like the environmental aspects influence the social aspects and vice versa.
Yeah, precisely.
So can you talk to us about how Indigenous people are involved in protection of habitats and potentially in combating climate change?
Yeah, it's a good question as well. And this is not an area of my expertise, but it's something that I've been fascinated with. So I've been trying to read a lot on it and discuss it with people who are on the front lines. And as I mentioned before, international policy and the way in which we design targets to protect the environment has been following a very Western definition of what the environment is. And thankfully, for the past 40 years, Indigenous communities are defined as, in many cases, although it's a contended term, as people who identify as Indigenous. And they've been finding very hard to gain more representation in these international discussions, both through their own groups, as well as through international organizations. And a few months ago, I was lucky to attend the IUCN Congress in Marseille, which is sort of the COP26 of conservation. And I was happy to see that they had a strong presence and they were present in many discussions and were part of shaping the new legislation that will define in which way we'll be protecting the environment. So currently, they're an integral part of conserving the environment, not just in the work they're doing in the field, but also in the way in which we define targets globally. But long before these 40 years, in which they've been trying to get more representation. Indigenous communities have been doing a great work in conserving the natural environment. And for millennia, they've been stewards of the environments. And that's why currently, the majority of the most pristine areas we have in terms of biodiversity in the world are either owned or tenured by indigenous communities. And to put this into perspective, there is a registry that's being currently put together to try to map all the areas that indigenous communities conserve. And it seems that it's 20% of the terrestrial area of the planet. So it's a massive area that indigenous communities have been conserving for ages. And they have been supported by, they've been doing this without support from the government or without acknowledgement. Very often they do it against the plans of the local governments. And this is, to put it in perspective, this is the size of the African continent. So it's a massive work. And I think this is currently our best hope for improving our conservation efforts, is to acknowledge the work that they've been doing in order for us to learn how to support them better, whether with finances or whether with the right acknowledgement or with resources. So I think there's no way in which we'll reach the next target, which probably will be set for 2030, which aims to conserve 30% of the planet by 2030. And there's no way in which we can achieve that without the help of indigenous communities, because they know how to do it best, because they've been doing it for very long.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, it's definitely something that we should be, it's people that we should be looking more towards for answers for these questions, because they are the people who have been doing it for a really long time, as you say, and is part of their culture to look after nature. And I think if we had that kind of commitment to the environment and nature, we would take better care of it as well.
Yeah, as I said, currently they have managed to gain representation. They fought through it a lot, through advocacy. However, having said that, they're still facing a lot of opposition in the local government. So that's one way in which they could be supported, I think, in the beginning, especially I think Philippines has the most deaths by people who are trying to protect the environment. So people who are currently on the front lines of trying to conserve nature, they face another position, whether from the logging industry or from different industries or from their own governments. So although we've made progress in acknowledging them, I think there's more to be done on local level, and especially when it comes to empowering their efforts with more resources, because it's a bit arrogant of us to suddenly acknowledge their efforts and say, okay, you've been doing a great work, keep on doing that and conserve the less of the planet for our benefits, because they also have their own needs, their own economy. They also want to have a better livelihood. They currently do and achieve better. And for us to throw this burden on them is unfair. So, we need to tangibly start supporting efforts, not only indigenous communities, but of all other countries that are trying to do it. And we need to acknowledge their efforts as legitimate ways of conserving nature and support them as such.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. We do need to stop, leaving it on their shoulders, and instead of, patting them on the back for it, be like, we're going to take over some of this load. We're going to try and make this a better world for everybody and for you. And just, try and make, really just try and make everything more equal and make the workload more spaced out for everybody, instead of having it all on Indigenous people's shoulders.
Mm. Exactly.
How could local communities be supported or empowered to help protect their local spaces? And how might that impact climate change?
Oh, and so this is like the most exciting part of my research. And I collect a lot of my own data, and I'm part of a team. It's called Fidelio here in Cambridge, and I'm Warwick now. And we just go into protected areas and we start talking to local people and try to understand what's going on. So we have a survey and we've got many responses. I think we're nearing 4,000 surveys answered by individuals. And I think that's a very exciting part of the work, because it varies so much how project areas function in different locations. So for instance, in a park in Greece, people are very connected to the natural environment. they really cared about the area and they felt attached to it. However, only 40% of them didn't even know that they live within a national park. So obviously there's something wrong there in the way that this park is governed and in which how it engages with the local stakeholders. And likewise, you can go to different parks where everybody is very actively supporting the park by volunteering and they know it exists and they're very happy for it to exist, or they were part of creating it themselves. There are other cases. I just came back this summer from Alonissos, which is a marine protected area in Greece. And it's one of the biggest ones in the Mediterranean. And then people are fuming because they are afraid of seals, and they've noticed that some seals have been appearing in the area to the extent that there was a seal, one of the seals was murdered this summer. So you have all these conflicts with nature, which you wouldn't expect in Europe that much. Like usually when we think of conflicts with nature and wildlife, we think of areas that have more well-known wildlife, unless it's maybe in some northern European areas, you have interactions with bears or wolves, but that's about it. So I think empowering local communities is, and this comes also from our data and our research, is the only way in which we can achieve our goals. And the reason is simple, is that it's, if you try to think of a protected area, which is this massive area of land or sea, and it's so hard to patrol it, it's expensive, and you know, you need cars, you need a lot of petrol to drive around it, and you need people to do it. And still, if you have many people on the job, there are many areas that won't be monitored 24/7, no matter what you try to do. So there's no way in which a protected area can, or the management authority of a protected area can enforce the rules without the support of the local population, who can act also as enforcers of the rules and even promote the mission that protectory has. So the only way in which national parks can achieve their goals very efficiently, both in terms of cost and time, I think it's with the support of local communities. Now, I know there are some national parks, especially if there's any American listeners, or I know in Russia and in Poland, there are a few like this as well, when it's like a fenced off area. So you have a protectory national park, which has fences, you need to pay a fee to get in, or there's clear gates and no one is allowed to live in there. And this is like an exception. In most cases, this isn't the case. So you need protectors to help. Now, in terms of tangible ways in which local communities have been doing great work in conserving the environment is, this is by volunteering. So it could be volunteering to count species, or to report wounded animals, or to report wrongdoing, to participate in cleanups of local areas. And this alone makes a big difference because it's much harder to disobey rules in a protected area with the local community supportive of it. But also at the same time, you cannot expect local communities to support a protected area. That makes it much harder for them to do their jobs. So for instance, in Alonissos, where I just was, local fishermen need to travel a much longer distance in order to access, to be allowed to fish, because the zones that were created don't allow them to fish 1.5 nautical miles from the coast, which initially they were happy with this, extremely happy, because, and this park was participatory. So the fishermen came together and they said, we want to conserve this area because we've noticed that fishing stocks are going down and it's harder for us to make a living out of our job. So initially they were supporting it, but then, they notice that they're not getting much in return from the park, and the managing authority isn't really protect that in the park isn't protecting their interests. So you need to have a protected area where respects the needs of local people and supports them in any way possible in order to expect them to return this favor and protect the park as well. In return. So in Alonissos, for instance, the first people who would report illegal fishing, you know, with a spear, which is illegal, are fishermen, because it goes directly against their interest for illegal fishermen to come in, whereas they have a license and they fish in areas that are allowed and they want to protect the fishing stocks. So we need to rely on them to monitor the seas.
Absolutely. So it's about really making sure that everybody is on the same side, and you know, you're not having rules that aren't worth following because they're negatively impacting the people who are being in these parks or working in these parks. But as well as that, it makes it's
no, it's right. Exactly. So you need to find what ways the locals rely on the environment and try and make sure that the rules that you're imposing aren't preventing them from using the environment in the way that they need to and they've been doing for centuries.
And
you can see the uses of a national park are so varied, and very often, like when I went to Alonissos, I went out of the season, so there weren't many tourists then, it's mostly the locals, and many of the old people you speak to, they will tell you that, oh, we would go, the park has many small islands in it that are also protected, so they would say, we would go to this island between the months of April and March and May to collect this herb. We would go to this island over the spring and with our herds of goats and then release them there and then graze there. And they say we were always protecting this area because we relied on it. So suddenly they felt that was very weird that a managing authority came to them and been saying, listen, you have been protecting the environment the way you should be. You've been doing a bad job. These are the rules you need to implement. If you come to locals with such a proposition, they may feel insulted and you may not be doing justice to the work they've been doing all this time. And maybe you haven't understood well in which ways it relates to the environment, on the environment. I think understanding is key. And it's much less, maybe it sounds very qualitative the way I'm describing it, but it's really not. And this is anyone who's interested or was working in business management. It's a similar concept in how you're trying to manage change in your business. So to introduce certain rules, you need to manage also the people that are part of this change and make sure that you respect their interests.
Definitely. I think it's really important that both sides are on the same side. Everybody is being heard and listened to. And, you know, the people who have been working to look after these parks should be the ones who are not like in charge, but the ones who are impacting what's going on with that park and the rules that are taking place to keep it protected. Increasing the number of protected areas as part of nature-based solutions approach to climate mitigation has been suggested. So what impact or challenges might this have for local communities?
So nature-based solutions, as you mentioned, is like a policy instrument that has been proposed a lot, especially in the European Union, and try to combine our efforts to stop the degradation of biodiversity, while at the same time trying to mitigate climate change, the impacts of climate change. It depends very often on the nature-based solution that we're discussing, because some of them can be very technical. For instance, planting specific species of trees by the coast to prevent flooding or the erosion of land, right? So these are very technical, where instead of building a concrete wall, relying on very specific species of plants that can do the work for us better and cheaper and more sustainably. So in these cases, they replace a very technical solution that we may have. But then, for instance, there is a program in the United States run through the Environmental Protection Agency where farmers would plant specific species of plants or hedges or trees on the fields, both in a way to encourage to increase biodiversity and to create a habitat for insect species or birds. So this whole biodiversity stuff, but at the same time, it also helps with soil erosion, with replenishing nutrients in the soil, with retaining water. So it has a dual benefits, and then relationship, this is a solution that's less direct in the sense that we're not building a wall to prevent coastal erosion. Instead, we're trying to increase productivity of a field by using a solution that we know is working in nature. We know that biodiversity, it does help an ecosystem and could help with productivity of farming crops. And it's a program that's been working quite well. It's been operating for 10 years. And so they propose the solutions that they would plant in their fields. And then they get specific funding from the EPA as a reward for doing so, so as a payment for doing it. And to answer your question more directly in terms of how these things are accepted by locals, I don't think there is a lot of, there haven't been any studies yet that have been conducted, or not many of them, that would examine the social impacts of nature-based solutions. But the schemes that I have in mind, which involve the European Union or any organization giving money to locals to implement certain solutions that help the environment, seems to be quite functional, and we can get support. So I think this combines the idea of payment for ecosystem services, where you pay someone directly for them to implement an ecosystem service, and combining that with nature-based solution the way that the European Union will do, I think it's a very, very effective policy. And that's why it has raised a lot of interest from policymakers, because it seems to be solving two major problems at once, while also transferring some benefits to the local communities and engaging them in the solving the problem.
Definitely. So you occasionally work with young people. You do talks in schools and things like that occasionally. So what kind of opportunities are there available for young people to get involved in biodiversity conservation?
That's interesting. And there are a few. So the first one, which I think could be more exciting, is there are several organizations which are running programs to help monitor local species. There is our institute, the Cambridge Conservation Institute here in Cambridge, is also running one such program, where you can report, for instance, sightings of specific species, and this helps a lot with counting species, so we have better understanding of how large the populations are, or their migratory patterns. So I think that's one way in which you can get involved, is by helping us measure biodiversity in different areas. So it's a fun game, because personally, I started playing around with this application recently, and I couldn't recognize various species before, but I can now, and it's quite exciting, because you feel more knowledgeable, whereas in reality, I can recognize maybe 10 species of birds. So that's one way you can do it. Another way, in general, I believe a lot in individual action, and specifically, we all hold, especially young people, we hold a lot of power through our consumer choices. Because if you think about it, the same way that our votes, when we're voting for a local government or a national government, carry a lot of weight, even though it's one single vote, similar with our consumer choices, we're making thousands of these choices every day in what we choose to buy. And currently there is a lot of clarity on which products are affecting more negatively biodiversity. For instance, our wedding products have palm oil in them. So I think consumer choices is the second way in which you can do it. And the third way is, I think, spending time in nature. I think that there's a strong argument to say that unless you have knowledge on something and visit often, it's less likely that you value it. So it's less likely that you understand, for instance, how important national parks are, unless you visit some and you see how they work. Especially in the UK, if you think about it, there's no, there are limited areas where you can go and enjoy nature, especially natural beauty. If you compare this, for instance, to continental Europe, there's no very high mountains or there's no giant lakes. It's very, because the landscape has been quite developed. So natural parks are especially valuable here, because the best way in which you can go on an affordable trip to enjoy nature. So I've been going to Peak District very often and Snowdonia and trying to explore national parks. And I think the value is very important. So that would be my third suggestion, is spending time in nature. And the fourth and last one is, I think there is currently a lot of room there's a high demand for people who have skills in environmental sciences and environmental economics, because we're trying to resolve major problems. And this, I think, would be my more tangible suggestion. Because there are three frontiers which we're trying to to do the research on, and we need businesses to be created in order for us to address biodiversity degradation urgently. And the first one is social impact assessment. So this is sort of the work I'm doing, where we're trying to understand how we interact with nature and how different environmental policies affect us, because currently we know very little about this. And this is one of the reasons why we cannot introduce effective environmental policies, because we don't understand their impacts well enough. The second one is partially what you mentioned with nature-based solutions. And there is a lot of room to open up businesses in this space, because conserving nature is very expensive, because currently nature conservation is not a market good unless you sell tickets to tourists. So it's hard to raise money for it. And we need governments to be involved and pay for this to happen. So there's a high demand to create business ideas that will help us raise money for businesses. And if you're interested in that, you can look, for instance, at ESG finance or different financial instruments that can help us raise money, which we could invest in protected areas and in the conservation of nature, and support such schemes as protected areas or nature-based solutions or payment for ecosystem services. So any business idea that can help us raise money better, that goes beyond just make tourist attraction out of a protected area, there is a great need for that. So if you're considering careers, then this is very important. The third one, I think, is in trying to value nature. So a lot of effort is currently put by economists and financial institutions in trying to value nature, because currently is a very important metric in understanding how good and sustainable companies and whether it's worth investing in it, is how, to what extent it relies on natural resources that will be depleted shortly, or to what extent this company has a good supply chain that goes beyond just getting goods from one area to another, especially this good will run out in the future or won't have access to it, or is causing damage to the environment and will be discontinued. So these three frontiers, I think, are very important if anyone is thinking of careers and that wants to make sure that they'll have a job when they graduate.
Absolutely. I mean, working at the Trust for Sustainable Living, we see just the impact that it has on kids and young adults who are, you know, increasingly becoming more interested in the environment and trying to learn what we can do to help the environment. And I think there's a really strong amount of kids in particular who are seeing those issues much clearer than a lot of adults are, and are really trying to make a change and do what they can, even at their age. And it's really, it's impressive, you know. It's and you know, if we can do anything we can to help them get into positions where they can do more, where they can have their voices heard, I think, you know, it's the best thing that we can do for them. I mean, other than also help with the environment.
Yeah, exactly. And until recently, this whole agenda of trying to value nature and seeing nature as an economic asset was part of some progressive thinking, but it's not the case anymore. In many countries, all companies are currently being sued because they didn't account for climate change enough in the modeling. For instance, ExxonMobil is being sued in the state of New York because they didn't, it's a public listed company, they didn't allocate enough time to estimate the risk that climate change has on their business model. And it's seen as being, that this could allegedly could deceive the investors into this company. And this is the case in many places. Currently, major financial institutions are trying to estimate these things in order to build better business models, in order to find better avenues for investing in companies. And so it's a proper career as well, beyond just progressive thinking.
So we've got the last question now. Yes. So we are recording this post COP26, but this is our question of the series, so it's still going to be asked anyway. If you could say anything to the world leaders, what would it be? What would you want them to hear?
I think it's what I'm really conscious about with climate change policy, and I know that many groups are focused on this as well, and I support this sentiment, is that whatever change is being introduced needs to be equitable, because it's very easy for developed economies to be currently sensitive about CO2 emissions, especially since we've historically caused a lot of it, or it's very easy to blame emissions on the Chinese or Indian government because they emit a lot of it, but we are the ones buying products that these countries produce. And so we essentially have exported our emissions to different countries. So I think equitable change is my primary concern. And equitable means both in the sense on a macroeconomic level that developing countries need to be given the same opportunities as we were given to develop. So a lot of the burden of paying for climate change mitigation falls on developed countries, which I don't think has been addressed nearly as much as it should. So for instance, the Green Fund, which is meant to raise 1 billion a year, at least it was before the COP, I'm not sure this will change now, hasn't been doing as well in raising that money or allocating it. So I believe on the macroeconomic level, we need to ensure that developing countries are given similar opportunities to develop. And on the macroeconomic level, that people within societies are given also equal opportunities to pursue their livelihoods, whether it is to ensure that they're not excluded from our biodiversity conservation efforts and to ensure that they don't live in energy poverty, because we found it very hard to provide sustainable energy while also making sure that that it's green. So I think this is my main concern. And I'm aware that we should also be interested with, you know, be alarmed with at the pace with which the planet is warming. But I cannot see a way in which we can introduce any change that is not equitable. And I can't see how such policies can be sustainable. There are several examples of this, of how people are protesting against taxes, increased taxes on gas, for instance, on fuel, and what a regressive effect it has on the livelihoods of people. So we need to be quite creative with the sort of taxes that we're implementing. So I don't think that any solution can be introduced that is not equitable.
Absolutely. I mean, I've interviewed quite a few people for this podcast, and they've come from lots of different backgrounds from different countries all over the world. And just seeing the difference in how environmental problems are viewed in different countries is really interesting. And especially in countries which are like less developed or less supported, you can really see that they are the ones who are doing the most for the environment, who are being the most sustainable. And I think that's actually partly due to having like a lack of support from other countries and, you know, a lack of funding and everything, because we are so focused on mass consumption, whereas that isn't as much of an issue in those countries. I feel like we are so good at like ignoring our own issues. And when you don't have a lot of other things getting in the way of that, it's quite clear to see what the environmental issues are and see exactly how they're affecting your own country. And if you don't have, you know, the excessive amount of products and just mass production that we have in our countries, it probably just looks quite a lot different.
Yeah. And precisely to bring it back to the point I made earlier, because we're so disconnected to the way that our economy interacts with the environment, because the mines that extract the cobalt we need are in a different continent, and because the waste that we dump them are in some area in our country, we don't even know where it is. It is very easy to form a wrong idea about what are the causes in terms of, you know, the general public, about what are the causes of environmental issues. And so, as I mentioned before, we hear that China produces a lot of CO2 emissions, but we are purchasing these emissions and we are the cause of these emissions. Or until 2018, that was the case with China as well, but now it's no longer, but it's many countries in Southeast Asia. We cannot recycle, we don't have the capacity to recycle enough plastic here in Europe. So we literally pay countries in Southeast Asia, and until 2018, we're paying China as well to take our plastic in. And this plastics end up on beaches, on fields, and people are trying to pick as much of it as possible to recycle it, but many of it, a lot of it doesn't. So when you hear about a lot of plastic in the oceans, it's not the plastic that you drop on the street somewhere in London that ended up in the ocean. It's a plastic that our government are paying other countries to take in, and it's washed off the shores and ends up in the sea. I think it's 70% of the plastic in the sea ends up there through such means. So we are just ignoring a lot of our problems and exporting them to other countries. And I don't think that's effective. It definitely has been working, because I said a lot of the plastic ends up in the sea. So yeah, I think this is a more structural change that needs to be changed, and we need to seek more transparency from our governments on how they're dealing with environmental problems. And to, yeah, we have the responsibility to become aware of how well we're doing in addressing them.
We absolutely do. Thank you so much for talking to me today. It's been really interesting. I've really enjoyed hearing your perspective of things.
And likewise, thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure talking to you, Sunny. And I'm very interested in the work that your organization does, and I think it's very important that I'm interacting with you
on the issues. So
thank you for inviting me.
Thank you very much for coming on.
This has been Speaking of Sustainability, a podcast by the Trust for Sustainable Living. Thank you to today's guest, Vasilis Gormas. Hosted by Sunny Tierney. Organised by Sunny Tierney. Music by Billy Painter. Find us online by going to trustforsustainableliving.org. Thank you for listening.